When we discovered who was paying a visit to our town this week, we just couldn't help trotting out our memory microphones for a chat with John Scott Trotter. Welcome back to Chicago.
Thank you very much, Chuck. It's a great pleasure to be here. I try to come twice a year now. A good friend of mine is your fine musical director, George Schulte.
Sir George. We've known
each other since 53, which is now getting to be quite a number of years ago. And so I always come hoping to be able to be here when the big things happen. And I'm here now to hear Das Lied von der Erde, which I did last week, and the Beethoven Ninth on Friday and Saturday, including rehearsals, which are a fantastic privilege.
Everybody doesn't get that.
No, and strangely enough, I go right along with it. The members of the orchestra feel that they're such a dedicated group of musicians, and they feel that they are there to work, and it really is closed from the musician's request. When I'm there, I sit way in the back in the shadows of the balconies, and pretty good seats there too. I mean, the sound is fine back there, and you can see most of the players. But this is the reason for my trip here now.
A busman's holiday.
Yes, I would say so, yes. And of course, visiting my friends here on North State Parkway, the Hunts, they are old friends, and I've seen their children grow up, and they grew up with the help of a marvelous housekeeper that came to the Hunts when they were first married, from three of us in the Hal Kemp band when we lived over on Schiller Street, and Schiller and Dearborn, and she came with the Hunts and was with them until she passed away a couple of years ago.
I see. When was the first time the Hal Kemp band joined forces with Johnny Trotter?
1926, when the band was organized at the University of North Carolina. I was a member of the original band, and I was with them from 1926 to 36.
Now, you were a pianist and
arranger? Yes, and the style that eventually became known as the Kemp style was mine.
Who else was in that early band?
Well, Skinny Ennis and Saxe Dowell, WGN people will remember. And Earl Geiger and Harold Dankers, and we had 12, 15 piece band at the Black Hawk.
Did you do the arrangement on Skinny's "Got a Date with an Angel"?
Yes, that was mine. I made that when we were on KDKA in Pittsburgh at the Penn Hotel there.
Boy, that must have been a fantastic group.
Well, it was. When the band was organized, Kemp and I were the only two who read music. As a matter of fact, the whole repertory was of head arrangements that were just learned by rote and note for note. And we played our first dance engagement, I think, with six numbers of actually arranged material. But after that, particularly when I started arranging, which was not until 1929, and it's very strange. The coincidence is a little amusing that the first arrangement that I made, Muddy Waters, was Crosby's first solo record. And of course, we had no idea that this really has no significance, but it's a strange coincidence.
Interesting. Yes. Well, of course, you had a long career with working with Bing Crosby, too.
Oh, yes. From the Kemp days, I went to California on vacation and did the orchestrations for Pennies from Heaven. And then I went back to New York and was what is now known as an A&R man. I don't know what we were known as. We just recorded. We just made records. And then I started with Bing in July of 37.
In July of 37?
Yes.
I found a Metronome magazine review from 1935.
George Simon?
George Simon, right.
Yes.
And he was reviewing the Kemp Band at the Manhattan Room of the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York.
Madhattan room.
Madhattan
room. Some press agent had his hand in that.
That's right.
You'll excuse me.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah, that's right. That was in there.
Yes.
He said, Simon said, the band plays only manuscript for which not enough praise can be heaped upon modest Johnny Trotter and quiet Gus Mayhew. They've helped Kemp plenty in developing a distinctive style that certainly has brought him close to the top.
That's very nice. That's George, of course, I'm going from here to Nashville, where the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences is having its spring Board of Trustees meeting. And, of course, George is associated with the chapter in New York, and I will be seeing him. Did this come from the Simon Says book?
Yes, yes.
I think that's a marvelous format. I think the big bands book that he put out was very good too, but I find that this is really tells it from that period and then his
right.
comments today.
Yes, it's interesting to read a review written from that time the show
Absolutely.
Was reviewed.
Absolutely, yes, yeah, yes. It's excellent. A couple of pictures in there that I gave George, the one particularly with Bunny Barragan when we were sailing down the River Thames in 1930.
Those were the days.
Those were the days. I mean, it's really, I couldn't ask for a better career, I mean, having lived in a particular time, because popular music was just taking on a different kind of, I suppose, not routine, but growing up. And many people think that we lost a great deal when it became, what does it say, only
manuscript?
Yes. I mean, but of course, we left room in there for ad lib choruses and that sort of thing. But maybe not enough. I mean, for instance, I don't think that there were any. Bunny Barragan did play with the band, and I don't think there were ever any Barragan choruses on a record, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a loss.
Also, when did you, you mentioned Bing Crosby writing that number that became Muddy Waters, that
yes.
became Crosby's. When did you first meet Bing Crosby?
Well, when he was a member of the Rhythm Boys, but at that time, you didn't know that he was Bing Crosby, or going to be Bing Crosby, you know, I mean, and so he was just a member of the Whiteman band. I mean, we admired the Rhythm Boys for their, you know, joie de vivre that they had in singing, but I met him in New York when we were playing at the Manga Hotel, which I was just in New York, and said the Manga, that I played at the Manga Hotel, and this a group of people, Manga Hotel, where was that, you know? It's now the Taft. They knew where that was.
Yes. Well, when did you first connect with Bing on the, was it your first experience with him on the Kraft Music Hall?
No. Well, the first experience was the doing the orchestrations for Pennies from Heaven.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Yes, and that was an independent production, and that's the reason I had the opportunity, because he was not working at Paramount, and there was no music department to lay this off on, you know.
I see.
And so that was the beginning of the association that lasted until 54, and then we did a weekly series in radio to 54, and then we have done a couple of television series that never really did take off, and then we had we've done some specials, and of course I see Bing and Catherine all the time now.
Well, I want to zero in on the old Kraft Music Hall.
Fine, great.
The format initially was an hour long.
That's right.
And I guess Paul Whiteman opened the Kraft Music Hall. Didn't
yes, it? And then. Bing started making some guest appearances, and it just sort of segued from New York to California, and Bing took over 1 week, and at that time, Jimmy Dorsey was playing the music in the early, I suppose, 35, when it began, Bing became Master of Ceremonies and took on the format of California. And Then Jimmy, of course, had an organized dance band, and California really didn't, it was sort of being, he had great exposure on the craft show, but as you know, dance bands took radio shows in order to get the exposure and then go out on the road in the spring and the summer and make it worthwhile.
Well, that's how so many of them
of course
started.
Oh yes.
Well, that's what jumping back just for a second, Hal Kemp and John Scott Trotter were in the Blackhawk.
Well, that was the great thing. Three times a night on WGN for 15 minutes, and as you know, around, I've forgotten what they call them various things around the town, or but this was happening on WBBM and WMAQ, and practically the whole country. You were saying just a while ago about being able to listen to radio and do other things. All of the college students were tuned into Chicago because they could study and keep up with, just as the kids are now, turn to the transistors.
Right.
Except I don't believe we listened to it quite as loudly.
Radio, it seems to me, in those days, was a more intimate thing than it perhaps it is today.
Oh yes, I think, well, I have a theory too that television is a much more intimate medium than is given credit. I say that the ideal audience for a television machine is one. Two people can look at it. Three, one of the persons then has to start making comment about it, and then from then on it just falls right flat. You cannot. We had, for instance, the Grammy show came from New York this year, and in California, since the time difference, we gathered at we put on black tie at 4:30 in the afternoon and arrived at the Century Plaza Hotel, and here were 500 or 600 people milling around about 20 direct line television sets, you know, I mean screens.
And closed-circuit TV.
Closed-circuit TV, and I was there the whole time, but I really didn't see the show until 4 or 5 days later when they played it for us at ABC in a small theater, you know, because the confusion, people walking in front of you, and so as I say, for me, the ideal thing is even for a television set. I'm sure that's the reason that many families have 2 and 3. Everybody has these televisions.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what was the, I kind of just quickly describe the scene at the Emmy, the Grammy Awards. What was the scene in Hollywood at the Kraft Music Hall just before you would go on the air? Where were you originating from?
Well, originally was down on Melrose, which was a small studio and now is KHJ, I believe. And of course, tickets to the show were very hard tickets. I mean, they were difficult to get, and there was an anticipation, the same as an anticipation for a Broadway production. And every show, because of the informality of the show, this was a great great radio show to watch. As a matter of fact, when I had particular friends who came, I said, well, what are you doing in the afternoon? Come and see the rehearsal, because that was when Crosby and his guests were at their most relaxed, and that was really something to see.
Was there much preparation for these shows?
Well, we thought there was, but in comparison with television, it was, as Bing says, it was a shame to take the money, you know? I mean, because, of course, I had to prepare so far as writing the scores was concerned, but Bing repeated quite a number of selections. When he would get on one, we would do it 4 and 5 times over a period of 2 or 3 months. So this was fine, but actually it was very easy. We only had one day of rehearsal, and we did the show in the late afternoon, and that was it. Early evening, rather.
Bing was, of course, had a great reputation for being super casual and especially relaxed, and yet almost everything that he did was had been written for him, wasn't it?
Well, the form of the script was written and sent to him on Monday night. The show was on Thursday.
Uh-huh.
Was written and sent to him on Monday night. And on Tuesday afternoon, it came back to the writer, Carol Carroll, and with marginal notes and sometimes of course, Carol was marvelous at capturing Crosbyisms, and which was jive or whatever they called it in that day. It wasn't really jive, but
no.
Really colloquial speech and au courant speech, I think you might say. And so, but Bing never was at a loss if something went wrong. I mean, he could fill it very amusingly, and of course, this is the thing that sometimes people decry about a taped television show, that the fluffs are taken out, you know, I mean, and this makes it sometimes lose a spontaneity.
Right.
Yes.
Did, talking about the taped and tape of today.
Yes.
Bing was the first major performer, I think, to use tape.
Yes. Recently I was in Washington and went into the Smithsonian, and we had made, at the recording exhibition there, we had made the Hal Kemp Band had made one of the first electrical remote records in 1920, the spring of 1925, in Atlanta. And so I think the electrical recording came in about 23, something like that. And then with Crosby, so I felt very historical then. And then, of course, there were the early Ampex machines, and we were absolutely the first ones to do recording on those. And the prototype, which a friend of mine brought back from, he was not a friend at that, I mean, he became a friend later, was the German magnetophone, I think, that he found at a, he knew about it and found one at a sort of a requisitioned enemy property, alien property dump zone, and brought it back, and that was the beginning of the tape era.
Well, Bing had, he insisted on tape because he wanted to be able to do his program when he wanted to do it.
That's right, yes. And he really wanted to get away from, you ask about the audiences in Hollywood. There were people who were professional radio show goers, you know, and as a matter of fact, if people remember, that you could hear these, over a period of time, you could hear these laughs that occurred in many of the shows originating from Hollywood, and these were people who went home and got a kick out of hearing themselves laugh on the, or their family did, because of course it was simultaneous broadcast at that time. You know.
They probably all joined together and made the first laugh track for TV.
That's right. And our unsung heroes,
yeah.
or whatever you want to call them.
Whatever.
Yes. But it was, this was, so Bing, at his own expense, transported the show to San Francisco for a very long period of time. I noticed that you have, that you brought me a tape of a show with Jolson on it.
Uh-huh.
Jolson was to appear with us in San Francisco, and he, on Monday, and on Sunday night he died at the St. Francis Hotel, and so this was it. We did many shows in San Francisco to get away from the Hollywood audiences, and of course Bing now lives in the San Francisco area, and this was maybe the beginning of this enchantment with that part of the country.
Well, radio listeners were enchanted with Bing Crosby and Ken Carpenter and John Scott Trotter and Kraft Music all for many years, and Well, gee, so many great things kind of developed from the Kraft Music Hall over the period of time. I guess I read somewhere that Jerry Colonna made his first song on the KMA.
Well, he played in my band as a trombonist, and he had this act that he did where he held this very long high swelling, you know,
yes.
And I think Our Sweet Mystery of Life or something like this was the ah was the one that was prolonged. And he went with us to a remote broadcast when Bing went up to do something at Gonzaga in Spokane, and Jerry was playing trombone with me on this trip. And he did this just for fun, and Bing, it was on the show the next week, and and this began the Jerry Colonna that was very amusing, and the many musicians have this talent that is sometimes brought out, and other times is just within the trade, as you might say.
And the Road to Mandalay was another one of those great Colonna things.
Oh, yes.
Of course, Bob Burns was more or less established, I think, before he got into the music hall.
Yes, I think he had done some Rudy Valley shows. Rudy Valley was produced by J. Walter Thompson, and many of the things went back and forth between those concerned with getting talent for these two shows. And Bob was with his bazooka. Of course, you know that the bazooka solos of Bob Burns were the beginning of the Spike Jones group.
They were?
Yes. Spike was my percussionist, and he fixed a set of tuned cowbells for these horrible accompaniments for the bazooka solo. And he was a very astute young man, and before you knew it, he had his group, and they made the Fuhrer's Face, and that started the whole thing.
And that started on the KMH, too?
Yes. Well, the idea was there. He didn't make, not until many years later did he make a solo appearance on the show, but it was a homecoming sort of thing, you know.
I can't talk with you about the Kraft Music Hall without talking about the famous KMH theme song and the magnificent station breaks that used to go on. You wrote that, didn't you?
Yes, with Carol Carroll. Hail KMH, hail rain and snow. Onward to victory, forward we will go. Stamping out, like a dauntless dromedary, stamping out our adversary, forward we will go forever. Hail KMH, our motto fly. Be brave and love each other, wear the old school tie. Like an eagle loose aloft, wave the pomegranate and puce aloft. And we went rah, 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 with a hey, nani, nani, and a ha-cha-cha, and then the NBC chimes came in, bom, 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 which was KMH.
Oh, that's great. Then that became a very important part of the program. Everyone looked forward to it.
It was a sketch. I mean, Ken Carpenter was the, it was Dr. Crosby, and Ken Carpenter was the student, and there was a KMH waltz and all sorts of things.
I remember reading something about the time there was a ban on music. I think the ASCAP or someone.
ASCAP has, and the networks were at loggerhead.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Bing's theme, "Where the Blue of the Night,"
yes,
couldn't be used on the air.
That's right.
And so the "Hail KMH" became the theme.
I really don't remember what happened that way at that. Of course, we went into the Stephen Foster things. Genie with the Light Brown Hat became a hit, as you know, and then of course BMI Music was organized at that time as a counterpart to ASCAP.
When you were on the program, they used to kid you a lot about. About your appetite.
Yes, and they could still do that.
But you are indeed a gourmet, I understand.
Well, I don't know about what, I hope a gourmet rather than a gourmand, and I am interested in food, and I think it's one of the necessary things in our life to fuel our bodies. Sometimes I overdo, but I do like good food, and I like simple food, preferably to food that makes pretensions. I mean, I really hate to go into a restaurant that says that it's cuisine de français of French cooking, and I usually go away from a restaurant that says gourmet food, you know.
Oh, with the flashing sign.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm expecting it to spell G-O-R-E-M-A-Y anytime. But I do, I like to, I don't go, I've never been to Hawaii, I haven't been to the Orient, but I try to go twice a year to Europe and do a little bit of restaurant sampling over there.
Oh, that sounds great. What did you do, John Scott Trotter, independently of the Bing Crosby shows over the years?
Well,
on radio?
Very little. I mean, this this is a good question. Many people said, and many of my colleagues went into the studios. I mean, the motion picture studios. Mm-hmm. I found when I first went to Hollywood that I did take a couple of jobs with Paramount, and which was natural from the standpoint of Bing being at Paramount. But then I found out that just the time that I was most involved in the radio program was the time that a big conference would come up. And I saw many of my friends, not many, but quite a few, I would say. Victor Young, for instance, who burned the candle at both ends, and unfortunately he's gone and I'm here. I mean, uh-huh. It was a calculated decision on my part not to try to bridge the two businesses, because the motion picture business is, and my stomach turns over whenever I go into a studio, even today. I mean, I don't like the atmosphere of the motion picture studio, and so fortunately I was able to make this choice, and the only hindsight that I have is that I didn't compose more. I mean, even beginning, that again was calculated. With Crosby, I would have, I don't know whether I would have been with him for 17 years if I had come in every periodically and Bing, here is my new tune, can we do it on the show? Because this was what he was confronted with every time he came into NBC. Uh-huh. I mean, this long line of the music men, professional men, Bing, here's our newest song, you know, and so on and so. And, but I should have been writing songs when we were at the Black Hawk. Uh-huh. Instead, I mean, Date with an Angel was very good for the band, but it should have been Date with My Sweetie or something like that, that I had written rather than somebody else. You know?
Are you writing anything today?
Yes, I'm, as a matter of fact, this is, I am involved in, I've had a very interesting career in that the Kemp time, the Crosby time, and then I went with George Gobel on television. And the last few years, I've been doing the Peanuts, the Charlie Brown specials, and Baba the Elephant, uh-huh. And Tom Adair and I have had 20 on that, so I am composing more. But of course, it's very difficult to, if you don't perform your music. It's very difficult to even one would say, well, you are in the business, you know, but it's really very difficult to achieve exposure for your compositions. So, and then I do some Pops concerts. I should do more, but I ask myself, where do they take place? And they take place mostly in the summertime, east of the Mississippi. And what is the weather like? Horrible. And what are the bugs and the thunder showers? And along corollary, along with my weight, I perspire quite a bit, and I really don't know how I would make a tour and keep clean shirts and clean performance clothes. But I do two or three programs a year in California.
Well, John Scott Trotter, we're happy that you trotted in to Chicago.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I appreciate chatting with you this afternoon, and next time you pop in, maybe we can do it again.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.